This is Resonance 104.4 FM. Flipping marvellous, as always. And welcome, I'm Nick Hennigan. This is Literary London on Resonance FM and, of course, also on bohemianbritain.com. How are you? How have you been since last time? I know, I can't hear you. But if you'd like to get in touch, you always can email me, radio@mavericktheatre.co.uk. radio@mavericktheatre.co.uk. Or you can now get me exclusively, Nick, N-I-C-K, at bohemianbritain.com. Oh, yes. Got my own special email now. Yeah. Nick@bohemianbritain.com. Let me know how you're getting on. Catherine California does. She started to use the bohemianbritain.com email. Thanks, Kath. Kath has been a regular for many years. You may know she always listens in California, always on the beach. Even when there was that storm, she said she was on the beach. And I have no reason not to believe her. Sun always shines in California. And we're sort of celebrating, well, nothing at all Californian, because, of course, this is March. Whenever you're listening to this, I'm recording this in March. And we're celebrating, well, actually not Charles Dickens' birthday, but we're celebrating. Obviously, St. Patrick's Day is celebrated throughout the world, and I am no exception. Hennigan, of course, as you can probably imagine, is an Irish surname. My folks are from Ireland. I think I've mentioned this before, and apologies if I have, from County Mayo, a little place called Bunnyconlan that no one's ever heard of, but they do have an annual, or they used to anyway, pre-lockdown, I haven't been there for a while. They used to have a fair every year, like a farmer's fair market and stuff like that, throwing straw bales over the, you know, yeah, anyway, you don't need to get the idea, but throwing straw bales was quite a big competitive thing, and it looked incredibly hard too. Yeah, so that's Bunnyconlan in County Mayo. I intend going over there this summer, hopefully. And we're also going to be celebrating the birth on the 29th of March. Let me get my dates right. 30th of March, I think, actually. Of a brilliant Irish writer called Sean O'Casey. Born the 30th of March, 1880. He was with us until September 1964. And I've played this once before, I think, but I thought it was worth doing again because I've got this fairly rare recording of Sean O'Casey himself, obviously most famous for his autobiographical works, The Plough and the Stars. And he sort of had some great quotes as well. Shadow of a Gunman, of course, was the other one. I like some of his quotes. He wrote, this is some of his Sean O'Casey's quotes, "All the world's a stage, and most of us are desperately unrehearsed." I quite like one. This was another one. "Money does not make you happy, but it quiets the nerves." I think I'm going to remember that forever. I had a conversation about, you know, if you're a writer full-time, and if you are a writer full-time, of course, you know what it's like. Yeah, we're never going to go on world cruises, are we? I mean, people still at my, I'm in my 60s now, I still get given holidays by very kind people who say, "You can come and stay in our house in Wales." So I kind of, that's, money does not make you happy, but it quiets the nerves. And also famous, he said, "The artist's life is to be where life is. Active life found in neither ivory tower nor concrete shelter. He must be out listening to everything, looking at everything, and thinking it all out afterwards." Which is kind of cool, isn't it? I mean, I quite like this, very current in terms of current politics. Perhaps, "There's nothing so passionate as a vested interest disguised as an intellectual conviction." It's great, isn't it? Yes, Sean O'Casey. We're also celebrating St. Patrick's Day, and a friend of mine has been on my the London Literary Pub Crawl. I wrote a thing called the London Literary Pub Crawl. It goes out every week in the centre of London, around Soho and Fitzrovia. And an Irish mate of mine is a big Charles Dickens fan, and he was over from Ireland for the weekend, and he wanted to do a Charles Dickens Literary Pub Crawl. So I'm going to do that with you and him. Well, he's going to listen to it. In fact, he's already done it. Yeah, he did it, a Dickensian pub crawl. It was something that he wanted to do. He's done it. It worked out quite well. So I'll tell you about that. If you fancy, if you're coming to London and you don't want to come on the London Literary Pub Crawl, bohemianbook.com, by the way, mentioning. It's a not-for-profit, so that's I'm allowed to do that. If you don't want to come on the londonliterarypubcrawl.com, then have a listen, and I'll tell you where you can go if you're a Charles Dickens fan around central London. And we'll do that after this next piece. But as I say, celebrating Paddy's Day in March, and also the literary birthday on the 30th of March, 1880, of Sean O'Casey, the Irish poet. And here he is in a fairly rare recording, Sean O'Casey discussing his own work back in 1962.
What happened the first night that the Plough and the Stars opened? I understand that's quite a story.
Well, it is quite a story, but it's been recited so often that it's a bit tedious now. A twice-told tale, you know?
Yes.
Vexing the dull ear of a drowsy man. That's what the story about the riots that took place in the theatre and the production of The Plough and the Stars is. It was just a violent reaction on the part of the nationalists that didn't like the critical nature of the play and assaulted the stage and attacked the actors. And the actors fought back and Yeats came out and denounced them all. And said they had misbehaved themselves again and finally called in the police because there was no possibility of quelling the disturbance. There were hundreds of people, men and women even, trying to get onto the stage and pull the curtains down and wreck the place. It wasn't an uncommon occurrence in Ireland. It occurred with Sing's play there. Before mine, the play by the Western World. And it occurred in this old 18th century theatre, Smock Alley, in Dublin, when the final end of that theatre was they set fire to all the chairs and furniture, and the whole theatre went up in smoke and fire because they didn't like a play that was being produced.
What is the background to reason that you won't allow your plays to be put on in Ireland now?
Well, it's there was a festival to be held in Ireland in 1958 called the Tostal. It's an Irish word meaning gathering together for entertainment, you know. Tostal. And I'd written a play at the time called The Drums of Father Ned. And the chairman of the committee of the council heard of it and he asked me, would I send it to him for consideration? And I said, well, I was very reluctant to do so, but after several letters, I decided to let him see it. And I sent him the script. It was in manuscript at the time. Sent him the script and he was delighted. It was just the play he wanted to cap and crown the festival. And that was all right. I was agreeable to me and everything went on all right, till a couple of weeks before the Tostal was to begin. And suddenly the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Dublin publicly announced that he wouldn't permit any priest in his diocese to say a vote of mass for the Tostal if any play by O'Casey or Joyce were produced during the event, during the festival. So that started all the pious people protesting. All the religious societies got up on their hind legs and demanded that the play be rejected and Joyce's play that was going to be done was to be thrown out. And the committee took fright and worked in such a way that I decided to withdraw the play. And because there was no protest made against the Archbishop's ban, I decided to ban all my plays in Ireland for the future, professional performances. And it's been banned ever since. I think that Ireland should have, at Dublin at least, should have protested against the Archbishop's ban on a play that play of a dramatist that was an Irishman. A damn sight better Irishman than the Archbishop, because at least he knows the language of his country, which the Archbishop doesn't. Not only am I an Irishman, but I'm a Dublin, a citizen of Dublin. The play was to be produced in my own city. I think it is an impudent and an uncalled for thing for him to ban a play written by me. One of my best plays. And a play that was hopeful and joyous and gay. There was nothing in it at all that anybody could object to. The hero actually is typical of the whole Catholic Church in Ireland, Father Nair. He's the dominant spirit in the whole play, urging the people to tidy up their towns, to paint their towns, to bring music to their villages, to bring art and literature. Everywhere that few Irishmen are gathered together, there can be nothing objectionable in that idea, can there? And that was the play he banned. Well, let him ban as much as he likes. I can live without the Archbishop's blessing.
Do you think the Roman Catholic Church has too much of a control over Ireland?
The Roman Catholic control, in my opinion, is too much damn control over the whole world. And there's a special and particular and dominant and absolute control almost over Ireland. Over the southern part of Ireland, that is, the Republic of Ireland. It hasn't got control over the northern province, which is mainly a Protestant one.
Yes.
And very bigoted too. One is just as bigoted as the other. They would protest against any play produced in Belfast that would have a laugh at a Protestant clergyman, I suppose, or any Protestant kind of practice. And the others would equally condemn and protest against a play criticizing the practices of the Catholic clergy. They're all the damn same. Wherever you get this dogmatic institutional religion, you get division, intolerance. It's only when people give up religion or the idea of religion altogether that you begin to get a bit of sense. Fair dealing and decent living. The English people are completely indifferent to religion, at least 9/10 of them are. And consequently, you can live in peace in England anywhere you go. They don't ask you what you are or where you go or what you believe. They don't care.
So you choose to live in here in Torquay?
I think the... Or any place
rather,
in England.
Rather than any place go back in England.
Yeah.
I'm not looking for a shortcut to playwriting, but what method do you follow when you're writing? For instance, do you compose on a typewriter?
No, I don't compose on a typewriter. I've written all my plays out in longhand. Not consecutively, not page by page in a copybook the way many dramatists have done. But jotting down thoughts and I couldn't do that when I was working.
Yes.
You see, then it would be impossible for me to sit down unless I spent the whole damn night at it. I used to occasionally, at dinner hour, breakfast hour, I used to carry a kind of a book with me and jot down thoughts and bits of dialogue that came into my head on the play that I was working at. And might be the last scene, or it might be the third scene, might be the first scene. And if I hadn't got the book with me, I'd look about for a scrap of paper and record them there before I went back to work. Then when I went home, I weaved them into the handwritten section of the play. And that was all done. It took me some years. It took me two years or so to write Juno. Many years to write The Plough and the Stars. And then I typed them roughly out on a typewriter and amended all that and changed it if I thought a change necessary. And if I didn't like a phrase here, I took it out and put another in, so on, trying to improve it as much as I could. And then I did what I call the final draft, which was sent to the Abbey Theatre. But even then, when the draft came back and they were published, when I received the first galley proofs from the publisher, I went through that and sometimes I changed a little here and there or added a little phrase that had come into my mind that I thought worth recording. And that, I think, concluded the writing of the play. But the play hadn't been written, or wasn't written, till the galley proofs were returned, corrected to the publisher. Then I considered the play written. And that took years of work. But how I was inspired by it, of course, is another thing. I was interested in everything that happened around me, and I'm interested still in everything that happens around me. Although I hadn't what I would call keen sight that normal people have, I had a very keen sense of observation, and that gave me keen sight for the little foibles and little gestures and little eccentricities of that individual and the other individual that I never forgot once I saw them. And I had a very acute ear for any little phrase that interested me. It remained in my mind. I usually added to it, or I wove another completely different phrase from it. But these phrases that I heard and the things that I saw were recorded in my mind and selected then, added to, and changed to suit my own fanciful idea of what this character or that character might say in the play. It's a never-ending work. You must never separate yourself from life if you're going to write a play. You must be ready to hear everything and anything, because you never know when a person may use an extraordinary and interesting remark. That may be witty, unconsciously in most cases, but consciously to you. And you record that, and you store it up, and you may use it years afterwards.
Your female characters, Juno, Nora, and Bessie, and others like them, they're always strong, and they seem to be trying to be a binding force in the family. Are these typical of Irish women as you knew them?
There are thousands of Junos in the Irish slums. The Irish people are extraordinarily good and kind and generous and self-sacrificing among themselves, the working classes. If you visit the slums, or there's no use of visiting the slums, you have to live among them to know them. You can't know them any other way. It's impossible. And if you live among them, you'll find that there are thousands of Junos helping each other out in any difficulty, in any illness. And if they can't help you positively, they'll help you in other ways by sympathy and kind words. Juno is not an uncommon thing in the slum. But my own mother was a typical example of what a Juno could be and was. But there are many more like her in the slums. I knew hundreds of them. I had always a profound respect and regard for them, toiling through life under tremendous difficulties and keeping a bright heart among it all.
You were very close to the poet William Butler Yeats. What sort of a man was he?
He was romantic about Ireland and his poems, and I think romantic about Ireland in his plays, but he wasn't so romantic about Ireland in the real issues of life that surrounded him and that confronted him. For instance, he wasn't very romantic when he stood on the Abbey stage denouncing the rioters in the Abbey Theatre on the night of the production of the Plough and the Stars. He was quite realistic. Yeats could be intensely realistic in dealing with the problem.
Why did he write so differently from what he felt in a practical sense then?
He had been influenced, of course, by the old Irish saga, the old Irish mythical stories of kings and queens, and he wrote very beautifully about them. And he was a very great poet. Everybody, I think, admits that Yeats was a great poet, as far as I know. A few are beginning to question his authenticity, or whatever you call it, as a poet, but I think Yeats and most literary men seem to agree that Yeats was an extraordinarily great poet. But Yeats, as well as being a great poet, was a great man. He's an extraordinary individual. And I don't think Ireland will get his like again for many a long year. Anything equal to the great Yeats. And Ireland is, so once Yeats died, the Abbey Theatre died with him. The Abbey Theatre's never been anything like the Abbey Theatre that Yeats and Lady Gregory, of course, led and guided. It's become now a mean, vulgar, commonplace exhibition of itself. I think the Abbey Theatre, I think God Almighty had a hand in obliterating the Abbey Theatre when he set fire to it, when it went up in flames. Oddly enough, while the Stars and Stripes was being produced in it. It was reduced to ashes. And the Abbey Theatre, as we knew it, is no more now. There's not even one of the foundation stones left. They're going to erect this new great theatre costing £250,000. That will be a fine building, I'm sure. The necessity that a theatre needs is a play, and where are they going to get them? There's nobody writing plays worth a damn in Ireland now.
Fascinating, isn't it? And very different times, fortunately for us. But Sean O'Casey, no one's writing plays worth a damn now. That was Sean O'Casey discussing his own work back in 1962 as part of our kind of St. Patrick's Day celebration. Also, of course, celebrating the fact that Sean O'Casey was born on the 30th of March, 1880. He passed away in September 1964. So that was fairly, you know, quite close to, it was 2 years before he passed away that we heard that. I'm Nick Hennigan. This is Resonance 104.4 FM. How you doing? This is Literary London, where we talk about things kind of literary. We're also on bohemianbritain.com. And I mentioned earlier an Irish mate of mine who has come over from, came over for a holiday, Paddy's Day, and he wanted to do, he's a massive Charles Dickens fan, and he wanted to do a Charles Dickens tour. So I kind of did a bit of research for him, and I thought what I might do is I'll share it with you now. So if you're ever coming to London, you're allowed to take notes and listen to this afterwards. This is a kind of a Dickensian pub crawl. It's all fairly compact. I don't know, I suppose a couple of 3 miles, maybe, if that. So if you'd like to follow in the steps of Charles Dickens, then best thing to do is go to the George Inn, which is on Borough High Street, SC1. It's also where we start. We do a Shakespeare tour every year in April. I go around. I used to work at Shakespeare's Globe, by the way, for a while. And we sort of go around and do a few recitals. And we start at the George Inn. It's a fabulous pub. It's the very last, apparently, of London's galleried coaching inns. And Charles Dickens used to drink there himself. He mentions the pub in Little Dorrit. And actually, I think it's still there. Charles Dickens' insurance policy is hanging on the wall. It's also a fascinating pub because it's owned by the National Trust. The building is owned by a National Trust. As I say, it's been there for a long time. And now, of course, if you look in the gallery courtyard, you look up and you can see the Shard. So you've got the very old and the very new, which is another reason why I love London quite so much. The George Inn, yeah. It's also, of course, the galleried inns is where Shakespeare and where theatre really kind of started off. Shakespeare was performing in pubs before theatres, and hence that's why you get the galleries in theatres. It was because most pubs were galleried in those days, or a lot of them were. So the George Inn, 77 Borough High Street, SE1. Again, if you have any problem with these, just drop me a quick email. I say radio at mavericktheatre.co.uk or nick@bohemianbritain.com. nick@bohemianbritain.com. So leave the George Inn, turn right, take about 15-minute stroll across London Bridge, which is always nice to do anyway, isn't it? And you'll end up in Leadenhall Market, where at 3 Castle Court, you'll find a pub called the George and Vulture. The George and Vulture, 3 Castle Court, in Leadenhall Market, which was the London base, of course, of Pickwick and his friends. It's mentioned numerous times, I think more than 20 times in the novel, The Pickwick Papers. And Pickwick has a particular liking for their port, served in those days by the pint. A pint of port? God blimey. Anyway, yes, that's the George and Vulture. And another 20-minute walk along Cheapside will take you to Ye Old Cheshire Cheese, which is sort of on Fleet Street. And it's another one of my favourite pubs as well. Dickens started there when he was a young reporter. He was drinking there. He was a young reporter on Fleet Street. And apparently it remained one of his favourites in the city. Apparently he also used to like to sit at the table to the right of the fireplace in the ground floor room opposite the bar. It's where Sidney Carton takes Charles Darnay for a good plain dinner and plain wine in A Tale of Two Cities. Of course, the Old Cheshire Cheese is also known as being the local drinking establishment of a number of famous writers, including the man who wrote He Who Tires of London, Tires of Life, for there is in London all that life can afford. Samuel Johnson, Dr. Samuel Johnson, of course. And his house is just behind the Old Cheshire Cheese, if you've got a bit more time. So from the Old Cheshire Cheese on Fleet Street, cut through Shoe Lane, through Saffron Hill, and the One Ton, spelt T-U-N, One Ton, which was another regular haunt of Dickens, and quite possibly, we think, the basis for the Three Cripples pub in Oliver Twist, which of course was the favoured drinking spot of Bill Sykes and his gang of thieves and vagabonds. Fagin apparently lives nearby, but yeah, so it's not the Three Cripples, but we think it's the One Ton on Saffron Hill. And then next, head towards Holborn and the pub called the City of York. City spelled C-I-T-T-I-E, City of York. This used to be the Gray's Inn Coffee House. Of course, coffee houses were very famous in London. It's where things like the Stock Exchange started, conversations in coffee houses. So Gray's Inn Coffee House, of course, was also where David Copperfield stops to ask after his friend Tommy Traddles. The rioters in Barnaby Rudge apparently also hide in the cellars of the City of York pub, Holborn. And then cut through Lincoln's Inn Field and past the old curiosity shop. It's obviously not the real one, but it looks quite good. It does look quite good. To a pub called the George the Fourth, renamed the Magpie and Stump in the Pickwick Papers and known in the novel for the 500,000 barrels of stout it kept in its cellars. Marvellous stuff. And then a further, about 10 minutes down from George the Fourth to down Russell Street and into Covent Garden will bring you to the Lamb and Flag, which boasts a little plaque in the alleyway commemorating Dickens' time spent propping up the bar. I've also spent quite a lot of time propping up that bar. And indeed, the Society of London Theatre's offices are just round the corner. Quite appropriate. It's a great pub, the Lamb and Flag. I've got pictures of it on my Instagram. Oh, yeah, I'm on Instagram. I think I'm at Nick Hennigan, am I? Yeah, Nick Hennigan. On Instagram. Check me out, baby, and say you heard me on the wireless or on the podcast. That'd be cool. Of course, the Lamb and Flag in Dickens' time had the slightly more alarming name of, it was called in those days, the Bucket of Blood. And then finally, the final kind of cool Dickens pub is to, if you head across Shaftesbury Avenue and then go into Soho, and down Grigg Street, where a pub called the Pillars of Hercules was almost certainly the Hercules Pillar in A Tale of Two Cities. It sort of kept its literary credentials for a while. Ian McEwan, Julian Barnes, Martin Amis were all regulars. So too was Nick Hennigan, but lots of people are worried about that. And Clive James named his second book of literary criticism after it. It was called At the Pillars of Hercules. Sadly, it's no longer called the Pillars of Hercules. It closed. Yep, it suffered rather badly during the lockdown. Then it reopened again as Jimmy Loves Gloria. That's what it was going to be called. Didn't last very long. Now it's known as Simmons, and it's kind of a cocktail-flavoured bar. They don't do real ale, but they've got sort of beer and stuff. And I know this because I was there a week or so ago for a birthday party. Downstairs as well, they've got numerous function rooms. We actually had a karaoke party, a private karaoke party for about 10 of us, which was rather jolly good fun. But I still, and they've kept the Pillars of Hercules sign, I think, which is just as well, because it was quite also very interesting. And of course, round the corner, it was Manette Street, named after one of his most famous characters. And that's your Charles Dickens pub crawl. Cool, we've been at it, haven't we, today? So happy birthday, Sean O'Casey. If you'd like to know any more, then please do get in touch. Drop me an email, nick@bohemianbritain.com or radio@mavericktheatre.co.uk. That's all we've got time for this week, but thank you very much for your company. I'll see you next time. We're on bohemianbritain.com, but mainly, this is Literary London on Resonance 104.4 FM.